Please be advised that although conclusions are provided in this presentation, which are simple to understand, some portions of this presentation can seem highly technical for the layman or those without an aviation background. We encourage those who may feel overwhelmed to pause this presentation and thoroughly review the educational tools offered and use perhaps your favorite search engine. Viewing this presentation more than once will also prove to be beneficial.
Pilots for 9/11 Truth is an organization of aviation professionals and pilots throughout the globe who have gathered together for one purpose. We are committed to seeking the truth surrounding the events of September 11, 2001. Our main focus concentrates on the four flights, maneuvers performed, and the reported pilots. We do not offer theory or point blame at this time. However, we are focusing on determining the truth of that fateful day based on solid data and facts. We stand with the numerous other growing organizations of firefighters, medical professionals, lawyers, scholars, scientists, architects and engineers, veterans, religious and political leaders, alongside the family members of the victims, family members of the soldiers who have made the ultimate sacrifice, including many of the Ground Zero workers who are now ill or have passed away, when we ask for a true, new independent investigation into the events of September 11, 2001. Thank you for taking the time to inform yourself.
September 11, 2001, New York City. A beautiful September morning turns into a nightmare. Millions watch as the world changes forever. Two aircraft used as missiles to force an apparent agenda. We've been told people from thousands of miles away hated our freedoms and our way of life. That they hijacked four aircraft, two which they managed to navigate to lower Manhattan with the intent to cause extreme damage to our freedoms and way of life. American Airlines Flight 11 and United Airlines Flight 175, both 767-200s, are the aircraft reported to have been used in the destruction of the World Trade Center. Pilots for 9/11 Truth have been able to obtain black box data from the National Transportation Safety Board, in which the NTSB claims to have come from United 93 and American 77. Thorough analysis of this data indicates many conflicts within the government story. Every government agency contacted refuses to comment. The black boxes for the aircraft reportedly used for the strike in New York City, however, do not exist. According to government agencies, the black boxes were never recovered, but according to other sources, they were. Demassey and Ballone, two workers at Ground Zero, were tasked by the FBI to locate the black boxes. They claimed three of the four were recovered. According to author Dave Lindorf, a source at the NTSB also states the recorders were recovered and given to the NTSB for analysis. The story dead ends there, as all government agencies, including the NTSB, now deny the existence of these recorders reportedly found at Ground Zero. What could these recorders have told us? Flight data recorders are built to withstand 3,400 Gs and temperatures of 1,100 degrees Celsius. The fact that people who worked at Ground Zero claim the recorders were found intact and other sources claim the recorders were sent to the NTSB for analysis, this is just more evidence which conflicts with what we've been told to add to the growing mountain of conflicting evidence. We don't expect the black boxes or the possible data they contain will ever be produced for the World Trade Center strike, so we will have to analyze data which is available. Since we do not have FDR data from the World Trade Center strike aircraft, We have to look elsewhere for any other type of data which may have been gathered and reported. One of the data sets we do have is position, speed, and a crude form of altitude data claimed to be from the 84th Radar Evaluation Squadron, also known as RADES. Initially denied by the FAA, a backdoor FOIA request produced this RADES radar data. Although reviewing altitude envelopes as compared to ASR radar with altitude reporting, also known as Mode C, and the fact the NTSB admits RADES data can have potentially large errors, it's not prudent to use such information for precise analysis, as others have done. The NTSB also performed a radar data impact speed study, in which they claim to have used ASR radar, which is much more accurate than RADES for calculating speed and altitude, especially when Mode C is available. The speeds cited for the strike aircraft exceed aircraft limitations set by the manufacturer for the aircraft reportedly used, unmodified airline fleet stock 767s. Can a 767 obtain such speeds? We have attempted to gather wind tunnel data from the manufacturer to answer this very question, but still without success. We search for other 767 aircraft accidents in which a comparison can be made and a benchmark set. Egypt Air 990, a 767 which reportedly exceeded its max operating limits, can be used as precedent as data is available from its flight data recorder, according to the NTSB. The NTSB calculates aircraft speed as 430 knots and 510 knots for American 11 and United 175 respectively, both reported as 767s. Those who make excuse for the government story attempt to cite Egypt Air 990, a 767 which reportedly was an intentional crash by one of the flight crew, as precedent that a 767 can reach speeds reported for the aircraft which allegedly struck the World Trade Center. According to the NTSB, which is disputed by Egyptian investigators, Egypt Air 990 first officer pushed the nose over to commit suicide, taking crew and passengers with him. During this dive, Egypt Air 990 exceeded maximum operating speeds for a 767, which are 360 knots and 0.86 Mach. We will cover the reason for assigning two airspeed limitations shortly. The NTSB reports the flight data recorder from Egypt Air 990 recorded a peak speed of 0.99 Mach at an altitude of 22,000 feet during its dive. 0.99 Mach is just below the speed of sound. Again, maximum operating speeds for a 767 are 360 knots and 0.86 Mach, respectively assigned as VMO, which is velocity max operating, and MMO, which is Mach max operating. Those who argue that since Egypt Air 990 reached 0.99 Mach, exceeding 0.86, that certainly the World Trade Center aircraft could do the same. What these people fail to realize is the air density at different altitudes and the corresponding effects on an aircraft. Remember, Egypt Air 990 reached its peak speed at 22,000 feet. World Trade Center aircraft were operating close to sea level. As you can see, when an aircraft descends, air pressure increases rapidly, directly increasing air density. There is a good reason Boeing assigns two airspeed for maximum operating limits. One is for lower altitude in this very dense air, in terms of knots, and the other for higher altitudes measured in Mach. The reason for this is air pressure, and therefore density, rapidly decreases with altitude up till about 22,000 feet. Knots as a unit of measurement in terms of the airspeed indicator is no longer accurate for measuring airspeed at altitude, and Mach speed is then utilized. In order to determine an accurate airspeed which has the same effects as Mach speed at altitude for an equivalent airspeed at lower altitude, there is an airspeed appropriately called equivalent airspeed, or EAS. Quote, equivalent airspeed is defined as a speed at sea level that would produce the same dynamic pressure as the true airspeed at the altitude at which the vehicle is flying, i.e., air contacting the airframe with equivalent effects. For simplicity, we will use online calculators to demonstrate, but for those who wish to calculate their own data, this is the proper formula to use. For example, Mach 1 at 22,000 feet based on a standard day temperature is 609 knots true airspeed. 0.86 Mach is 522 knots. 522 knots at 22,000 feet, remember, in less dense air has the same effects on an airframe as 369 knots at sea level in more dense air on a standard day. Big difference at low altitude versus higher altitudes for the same pressure acting on the airframe. As you can see, this is why Boeing derives two airspeed limitations, one in terms of knots, the other in terms of Mach number. Notice the similarity? Again, according to the NTSB, the alleged United 175, reported as a 767, reached a speed of 510 knots. An experiment was allegedly performed in a 767 simulator to observe if such an aircraft can obtain United 175 reported speeds at low altitude. We say allegedly, as no information was given to confirm such an experiment took place. However, they claim they were able to accelerate the simulator to 0.86 Mach at 2,000 feet, which is 568 knots for this altitude on a standard day. They claim the simulator was relatively easy to control at such speeds, and their conclusion was, it is highly probable that American 11 and United 175 could easily make the airspeeds quoted in the official reports and as seen in the video footage. They also make the claim 0.86 is the max operating speed for all altitudes, ignoring max operating speeds set as 360 knots by Boeing for lower altitudes. Again, what they fail to realize are the effects of air density at high altitudes compared to low, and the reason Boeing assigns two types of airspeed for max operating limits. 0.86 Mach, 568 knots at low altitude has the same effect on an aircraft as 805 knots, or 1.32 Mach at 22,000 feet on a standard day. The researchers who have made such claims based on their alleged simulator experience may want to inform Boeing that their 767s can obtain supersonic Concorde-type speeds in a, quote, flat trajectory and be relatively easy to control in mid-level altitudes. This is what happens when you exceed such maximum operating limits set by the manufacturer. Granted, there is a safety margin built into the maximum operating limits, but there is a reason limits are assigned to aircraft, as you can see here.
In the slow XL 85.
Hey, terminate. Knock it off. We lost it.
Since there are such margins of safety built into such limits, and Boeing has not been very cooperative to share wind tunnel data in order to determine when the aircraft start to break up in flight, we do have data to use as a benchmark from the National Transportation Safety Board. Again, according to the NTSB, Egypt Air 990 reached 0.99 Mach at 22,000 feet as its peak speed in a dive. 0.99 Mach is 603 knots at 22,000 feet, and its equivalent airspeed is roughly 425 knots at or near sea level. This is only 65 knots over VMO. Again, according to the NTSB, United 175, the aircraft which allegedly struck the South Tower, reached a speed of 510 knots, 150 knots over its max operating, and the equivalent of 85 knots, that of Egypt Air 990. Using Egypt Air 990 as precedent, it is impossible for the alleged United 175 to reach 510 knots, period. Let's see if United 175 could have continued control flight at such a speed. Remember, those who conducted the alleged simulator test claimed that the aircraft was relatively easy to control at 0.86 Mach near sea level. According to the NTSB and reports, Egypt Air 990 had two significant debris fields telling us the aircraft broke up in flight. I think we'll all agree that the aircraft which suffers structural failure in flight is difficult to control. But at which time in flight did this occur? The best indication we have right now is based on electrical power loss. The flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder stopped recording a few seconds after peak speed, as did the transponder which failed, indicating loss of power. The NTSB speculates loss of power to FDR and CBR due to the engines being shut down, But this isn't valid. The FDR and CVR do not automatically lose power when the engines are shut down. The FDR and CVR are essential items and have redundant systems for power in the event of an engine shutdown. Also, the ATC transponder power loss would not occur with the engines being shut down. Power loss to multiple essential items indicates when the airframe started to bend or break up in flight, enough to cause the power loss of all essential and standby power systems. Again, the equivalent of only 65 knots over its max operating limit. We now know an unmodified 767 cannot reach speeds reported for the South Tower strike, but it's also impossible for United 175, an unmodified 767, to have continued controlled flight at 150 plus knots over its max operating limit, according to precedent set by Egypt Air 990. So, if this isn't a stock 767, what is it? Was it a modified, beefed-up 767 to obtain such incredible speeds? If so, did 19 Islamic extremists do the modifications in their caves in Afghanistan? The only other possibility here is that the NTSB data for Egypt Air 990 is false, combined with the NTSB calculated radar study for United 175 is also false. If you believe this to be the case, this has grave ramifications for flight safety, and you should think twice about getting on your next flight. Clearly, the simulator used in the reported experiment, if in fact such an experiment was performed, as it's only hearsay at this point, was not calibrated with any type of crash logic and allowed speeds equivalent of breaking the sound barrier for a 767 in mid-level altitudes. It's interesting to note, the individuals who conducted the simulator experiment also claim the destructive speed for a 76 or 757, as stated by Boeing, at sea level, is approximately 420 knots. This is consistent with Egypt Air 990 power loss when calculating equivalent airspeed. Yet the researchers also claim the aircraft was easy to control at more than 150 knots over max operating. Do these people even understand their own research? Apparently not. Cockpit simulators are not meant for simulating aerodynamic stress on an aircraft. Cockpit simulators are meant for practicing profiles and emergency procedures for pilots. For example, there is no possible way to precisely simulate the effects of real-world G-loads in a cockpit simulator. You're always at 1G. For aerodynamic stress, wind tunnels are utilized for more accurate simulation and measurements. Using a cockpit simulator to measure aerodynamic stress is like using a compass to determine your altitude. Pilots, when training in simulators, practice profiles well within the limits of the aircraft. There is no reason for an airline to train pilots outside the aircraft envelope, as pilots are trained to keep the aircraft well within its limitations. The reason for crash logic not operating on a simulator could be numerous, with the leading candidate most likely being cost. But it is also interesting to note, the simulator researchers claim to have pulled the overspeed circuit breakers so they wouldn't be annoyed by the overspeed warnings. Did the researchers unknowingly pull the crash logic for overspeed on the simulator? It appears so. Now, one could argue that the speed reported for United 175 was a ground speed, and that you cannot compare a ground speed to an airspeed. This certainly is a valid argument, and perhaps would be a good argument, if the winds were out of the south at almost 90 knots, giving United 175 a push to the South Tower. But the fact is, the winds were mainly from the north, northwest, and light. If anything, the airspeed of the target which was observed impacting the South Tower was more than the ground speed, making it even more unlikely it was an unmodified 767 or United 175. Now for the real eye-opener. As we check, United 175 reported low altitude speeds as the equivalent Mach number at altitude. Again, the airspeed which was reported for United 175 is 510 knots near sea level. At 22,000 feet, the speed needed for the same effects on the airframe is 722 knots, or Mach 1.19. Again, I guess Boeing built 767s capable of supersonic flight at altitude and still controllable to hit a 208-foot wide target with a 25-foot margin for error? American 11, the aircraft which was reported to have impacted the North Tower, was traveling at a lower speed according to the NTSB. The speed reported for American 11 is right on the edge of in-flight structural failure using Egypt Air 990 as precedent. The speeds reported for this flight do look possible, but certainly not for the alleged United 175, again using Egypt Air 990 as precedent. The conclusion is there are many different speeds reported by different agencies for the World Trade Center strike aircraft. We use the speed reported and calculated by the agency with the most experience on such a matter, the National Transportation Safety Board. Those who make excuse for the government story must reduce such speeds calculated and reported by the NTSB to under 420 knots for both aircraft in order to maintain their theory. United 175 speed reported on its approach to the South Tower has the same dynamic pressure effects as supersonic speeds at a modest altitude of 22,000 feet. American 11 also experiences dynamic pressure above Mach 1 at 22,000 feet, according to the data. American 77, a 757, the aircraft which allegedly struck the Pentagon, also experienced the same. Although other factors come into play in the transonic ranges, dynamic pressure is dynamic pressure. Math doesn't lie. Of course, this is all according to the speeds reported either by ASR radar or FDR data. Again, only two possibilities exist. Either the speed data obtained from various sources is inaccurate, and therefore flight safety is in jeopardy and has major ramifications for the airline industry, or the aircraft observed are not the same as the aircraft reported, in which case the story we've been told by the 9/11 Commission is a lie. We at Pilots for 9/11 Truth would like to make it clear that we do not endorse any theory, which is also clear in our mission statement atop our home page and subsequent analysis we have provided over the years based on data. This World Trade Center analysis is based on precedent and benchmarks set by data provided by the NTSB in terms of Egypt Air 990 as compared to the data provided for the World Trade Center aircraft, and in no way validates any theory. However, the analysis conclusively proves the story we've been told by our government is at the very best not accurate, and at the worst, intentionally deceptive for an apparent agenda. Your mileage may vary. Either way, the events of 9/11 have once again been proven a grave issue which needs urgent, serious inquiry. We're talking with Ralph Kolstad. Commander Ralph Kolstad flew for American Airlines, I believe it was?
Yes, I flew for Continental for 6 years and then for American for 21 years.
And you flew the
767 International Captain.
Okay. And we're going over the speeds based on the reported speeds by the NTSB for United 175, the aircraft which allegedly struck the South Tower at 510 knots. We briefly talked about the benchmark and the precedent set with Egypt Air 990 at 0.99 Mach, but that was at 22,000 feet. The equivalent airspeed is 420 knots at sea level, which is 90 knots less than United 175 supposedly reached. Well, how do you feel about, you know, United 175 reaching 510 knots?
Physically impossible. To have a clocked airspeed of 510 knots with a commercial airliner at sea level is physically impossible.
If it's going 510 knots at sea level, Mach at altitude is above Mach 1. Do you think...
physically impossible. They're not designed to do that.
Yeah.
The airframes are just too big. They don't have the sweep. They don't have the excess power to go supersonic. Commercial airliners were not designed for that and physically can't do it.
Yeah. All right. Well, so then what do you think, since, you know, these aircraft can't perform those speeds, obviously... the NTSB claims that they did those speeds, then obviously the only conclusion to draw is that the aircraft which struck these towers were not the aircraft that were supposedly told they were.
That's certainly one possibility. I can only look at what, you know, we've seen on the TV about the impact from the two towers at in New York and the Pentagon, and the impacts were relatively straight level. And for a 757, 767, relatively straight level, I would find it extremely difficult to believe that they're doing any more than 300 or 350 knots. And so to come up with a 510 knots is pretty insane. It defies all laws of physics.
Okay, so are you thinking that the NTSB and the radar is inaccurate? Or do you think that that it's possible that these airplanes were beefed up to do those speeds?
Now, that's a real good question, and that certainly is hypothetical. In both cases, either the radar is wrong, the information they're giving us is misleading, or they weren't the airplanes. They sure looked like a 767, and maybe they were modified substantially.
The following interview is with Rusty Amer, a 75767 captain who flew for United Airlines and has been a captain on the actual aircraft reportedly used on 9/11. This is what Rusty had to say about the NTSB speeds reported of the exact aircraft he has logged flight time.
And you've been with us for quite some time, and I thank you for speaking out, my friend.
You're quite welcome, Rob.
The alleged United 175 that impacted the South Tower was at 510 knots. And, you know, comparing that to Egypt Air 990 at 0.99 Mach, which was at 22,000 feet, the dynamic pressure equivalent at lower altitude for that is only 420 knots. Uh-huh. And this aircraft supposedly broke apart in flight.
At that kind of speed, even if you can get a 767 up to 510 knots, which is very, very doubtful. I think it's impossible to get that kind of speed on any commercial airplane. Even if you could.
Well, the Concorde can reach those speeds, can they not?
I don't think so.
The Concorde.
Not at sea level.
Oh, at sea level. Oh, good point.
So, you know, to get an airplane, especially an old 767, that this United aircraft was.
Which, by the way, you have time in this aircraft, don't you?
Yes. To me, it's impossible. You know, any pilot that has been in a commercial jet would probably laugh at if you said 510 knots.
Imagine trying to park your car in a garage at about 150 miles per hour without hitting the sides of the car on the opening of the garage. As you can see, the operator of the vehicle needs to be very precise. Considering the best hijacker pilot was Hani Hanjour, and he wasn't allowed to rent a Cessna 172 single-engine propeller-driven aircraft due to the fact he couldn't control it at 65 knots, it's highly unlikely a pilot of less capability could control a heavy jet zero training in type aircraft at almost 10 times the speed with about a 25-foot margin for error each side of the wingtip. The width of the World Trade Center is 208 feet. Wingspan of a 767, 156 feet. Here's a better example. Ever been to a Jiffy Lube or a similar place to get your oil changed? You drive in, stop, they change your oil, you keep driving straight to drive out. Now imagine driving through that narrow opening at over 150 miles per hour without scratching your car. However, you are familiar with your car. You have many hours operating it. So this scenario isn't quite the same. Now imagine yourself behind the wheel of a tractor trailer for the first time attempting the same maneuver. Could you do it? This is an interview with an experienced FAA check airman for his airline. What this means is that he flight tests and passes or fails pilots at his airline. Dan Gavados attempted to duplicate the World Trade Center attacks in their simulator in the weeks following September 11th with his line pilots. These are pilots who already have thousands of hours and can control large transport category aircraft at high and low speeds, not to mention a 172 at 65 knots, unlike the, quote, hijacker pilots. This is what Dan had to say when attempting to duplicate the attacks.
And after their sim training period, I said, hey, guys, let's try something. Let's see if we can hit these buildings like we saw happen.
Yeah.
And this was in a 737 and, you know, a smaller, a lot more maneuverable airplane. And so I set it up for these pilots. And, you know, keep in mind these pilots are, you know, have many years of experience. And I set up New York, and we, you know, they all just took turns trying to hit the buildings, and they couldn't do it unless they slowed down to almost landing speeds.
Wow. I didn't know that. Tell me about that.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and they could not hit those buildings, you know, at the high speeds. They couldn't do it.
Yeah, well, I guess they were getting into all kinds of Dutch roll and everything then, right?
Well, that's right. That's exactly what was happening.
Things to remember about the Dutch roll. Firstly, there is a damping ratio, which is how quickly the motion dies down. There's a frequency, which is the speed of the motion itself. And there's the roll-to-yaw ratio, which is a measure of how much roll, how much bank angle, to how much side slip. And those are the three aspects that you have to assess. And they're all important in their own way.
There were Dutch roll problems. There's, you know, people don't realize that to hand fly an airliner at those speeds is extremely difficult. It's very hard to hand fly an airplane at those speeds, and particularly if you're a novice, because a novice that's learned and you know, all of their experience is on little airplanes, they over control everything. But you gotta understand, going, you know, 300 knots in an airliner, and you move the controls like you would expect to do in a little airplane.
Right.
Well, I mean, you know, you couldn't stand the G-forces. Everything has to be just fingertip control. So basically, out of the 10 times each guy did it, nobody could do it. I finally was able to do it on probably the last time. I jumped up there and tried it. And but I'm telling you, that kind of opened her eyes, and I said, you know, something is not right. We were finding that all the time. Even these airline pilots that have, you know, thousands and thousands of hours of experience had a hard time controlling an airplane at those speeds. So,
even when I was making the film, okay, and I was doing all those different maneuvers to set it up to hit the Pentagon, how you see all, coming in from the top, coming in from the side, coming in from the other side, going into where Rummy was sitting on the other side of the building, and then I tried to line it up exactly how the official story states. It took me about 5 or 6 tries, even in Microsoft Flight Simulator, to get it down just right.
Landing speeds are about 5 times less than the speeds reported on 9/11 at the World Trade Center. The interviewed pilots were able to impact the World Trade Center as done on 9/11, on first attempt, at landing speed. It's a whole different animal when attempting to do the same thing at more than 150 knots over maximum operating speed for the type aircraft. The slightest pressure doesn't even have to be an actual movement on the steering wheel or what we call yoke, will produce very large changes in aircraft direction, or even structural failure. The government wants us to believe these hijacker pilots, whose best pilot couldn't control a 172 at 65 knots, had trouble landing it, and then they got 3 aircraft completely inside an object with margins for error that didn't exceed 33 feet in the case of the Pentagon, or 25 feet in the case of the World Trade Center, at over 400 to 500 knots? You decide.
And you were talking about how hard it is, even at landing speeds, to hit a small target. So talk a little bit about that, what you were saying with, an aircraft carrier?
We had a program in our simulator, one of the simulators at United, that some WizKid had put in, where you could technically take a 757, take it over to San Diego and try to land on an aircraft carrier, and just for fun. This obviously was not a part of training curriculum. And
now, were you flying the 7.5 in the sim or the 7.6 at that time?
This was a 7.57.
Okay.
Which, as you know, much smaller than a 767. But we were both qualified on both aircraft, 767 and 757.
Would you say that the 7.6 or the 7.5 is more maneuverable?
7.5 is more maneuverable, obviously.
Okay.
Especially at light weights,
So tell us about your experience in trying to hit this aircraft carrier.
We had just finished our PC, me and the co-pilot.
And a PC, for those out there, is
our 6 months proficiency check at that time. And I think we did a good job, and the check airman, we had a little bit of time left, and he kind of wanted to reward us. He said, would you like to go land on an aircraft carrier? And we went over to, took the airplane over to San Diego, and we tried to do some touch and goes on this aircraft carrier, which was pretty fun for us. First time the first officer tried, I think he made about four approaches try to land that thing on the aircraft carrier. And mind you, this was a very light aircraft. In other words, nowhere in heavy weights, so our approach speeds were pretty low. I want to say around 120 knots or so, which is quite low. The lower airspeed, the better and easier to obviously handle and maneuver it.
Yeah, sure. You're basically going behind the power curve to, doing a short field landing in a 7.5.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, our aircraft did not have a tail hook, and so we weren't trying to catch any wires or anything like that. We're just trying to make it on the deck of this aircraft carrier. There was no wind situation. It was basically a perfect condition, almost unrealistically perfect. And when it was my turn, it was probably the hardest thing I've ever done, trying to land this big airplane on an aircraft carrier.
Right.
I think my first try, I sheared the gear off the airplane because I hit the side of the carrier. And then my second approach, I managed to do it. But
And let's reiterate that these are at landing speeds for a short field landing.
Exactly. Landing speed in perfect condition, no wind, it was the hardest thing that I've ever done. And obviously I mashed it in there on the runway. It was a real arrival. I wasn't looking for a smooth landing or anything like that, just trying to get it in there.
Now let me ask you a question, Rusty. Being a 767 captain, with the amount of time that you have, what, 25,000-30,000 hours?
At that time, yeah.
With United Airlines, if you were in a 767, which you say that is less maneuverable than a 757, could you get such an airplane with a 156-foot wingspan into a 208-foot target without having any time in the type aircraft?
I don't think so. And as you were saying, 510 knots, according to NTSB or
that's right.
That's what?
Supersonic speeds.
Yep.
And just mid-level altitudes. Now,
with those kinds of numbers, I think it's impossible.
We already know that based on Egypt Air 990 as precedent, that not only does a 767 not have the capability of such speeds, but according to Egypt Air 990, such speeds also cause structural failure. But let's explore the hypothetical that an unmodified 767 can obtain such speeds intact. Again, there is a reason the manufacturer sets speed limitations. These factors include flutter, as we have seen, but other factors include control surface effectiveness, center of pressure versus center of gravity, trim characteristics, to just name a few. When aircraft exceed their design limits, control effectiveness becomes increasingly non-existent. For example, as airspeed increases, the wing generates more lift. Therefore, the pilot needs to push the nose down. Trim is used to relieve these pressures. There comes a point when the airspeed is so great that the throw on the elevator and trim are at their limits and no longer can keep the nose down, and the aircraft is now said to be out of control. The elevator and trim only move so much. Conversely, and a bit more technical, center of pressure moves aft as airspeed increases. If this center of pressure becomes too far aft, the controls may reverse, in which you cannot keep the nose up. This is known as Mach tuck, and the faster you accelerate, the more the nose wants to push down. What happens when going downhill? The aircraft wants to accelerate more. Again, the aircraft is out of control. Further control reversal comes into play. Ailerons are used to turn an aircraft. One goes up, the relative wind hits it and pushes that wing down. On the other wing, the opposite aileron is moving down to push that wing up. At excessive speeds, the down aileron grabs more air from the relative wind and actually causes more drag, pulling the aircraft in that direction, opposite the turn. The pilot wants to turn right, but the aircraft turns left. This is called control reversal, and again, the aircraft is out of control. These are just some of the basic reasons manufacturers set airspeed limitations for an airframe. Again, hypothetically speaking, even if the structure remained intact at such excessive speeds, could these hijacker pilots counter such factors? Perhaps this is just another reason why so many experienced aviation professionals are raising their red flags on the government story, and the list grows. Bottom line, it's highly unlikely the damage done to the World Trade Center and the Pentagon was caused by the reported hijackers in which their best pilot could not control a single-engine Cessna at 65 knots. Some like to argue that since the World Trade Center buildings were some of the tallest in the world, that the buildings make an easy target to hit with a commercial airliner. Navy pilots take pride in the fact that they are set apart from other pilots since they perform operations from an aircraft carrier with very small margins for error. Navy pilots know the skill it takes to hit such a target, even at landing speeds in highly maneuverable jet fighter aircraft. It is contradictory to suggest that the World Trade Center is so large as an excuse for hijacker pilot ability while at the same time taking pride in some of our best pilots who use almost the same size target to tout their stick ability. Combine that with the added controllability factors at high speeds and dynamic pressures, it is absurd to think these hijacker pilots who couldn't control a 172 at 65 knots could easily hit their targets completely and thoroughly, especially being 3 for 3. Pilots for 9/11 Truth have now analyzed the aviation aspects for each event which occurred on 9/11. The Pentagon, Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and now New York City. Thorough analysis proves what we've been told by the 9/11 Commission is a lie. It's interesting to note the reported aircraft, which have numerous videos and witnesses to the event, do not have recorded black box data available, and of the data of which is available, prove impossible speeds for airline fleet transport category aircraft. Those events for 9/11 which do not have any videos and very limited witnesses, most conflicting with the government story, do have data available, allegedly from these aircraft. Unfortunately, all data, whether from black boxes or radar, does not support the government story, or is physically impossible. It appears at every turn there are grave conflicts with the government story. Why is current foreign and domestic policy being dictated based on an investigation with a growing mountain of conflicts? Why was the 9/11 investigation underfunded and set up to fail? It's time to get to the truth. Contact your representatives and demand a thorough, independent investigation. Advise them to be on the right side of history. Like a startling sign.
Your voice was all.